Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers says the way we manage our economy needs to change.
Well, my essay is all about how we strengthen our economy and strengthen our institutions in a way that strengthens our society and strengthens our democracy. And it differs from the approach taken over the last decade or so, because I think for the best part of a decade, we've been pretending as a country that we have to choose between our economic objectives and our social objectives. And in the process, we haven't done a great job of satisfying either set of objectives. And so what this tries to do is to say that we would be much better off if we had the public sector and the private sector working together in the service of our national economic goals.
That sounds great. That's our Treasurer Jim Chalmers there. A lot of strengthening going on. What economic system do we need right now to manage the financial troubles of the moment, but also the human and environmental needs that we have now and into the future? Whether it's Treasurer Jim Chalmers' vision of values-based capitalism or something else, Danielle Wood is the CEO of the Grattan Institute. Great to have you with us on the program, Danielle.
Thanks, Hilary.
And Richard Holden is a professor of economics at the University of New South Wales Business School. And one of his books is called From Free to Fair Markets, Liberalism After COVID. Richard, welcome.
Good morning, Hilary.
Danielle, how did the Treasurer's vision for the future strike you? Was it a jaw on the floor or a happy dance kind of moment?
I should say at the start, I think it was really great to see a senior minister and particularly the Treasurer setting out a broad vision. And I don't think we've had that for a while, someone sort of really try and sit down and put pen to paper and talk about what they're about. So I think that was really important in itself. It wasn't a jaw on the floor moment at all, Hilary. I mean, I think it largely reflects contemporary economic thinking, the idea that the economy is not all we care about. There are a whole lot of things that, as a country, we want governments to help deliver. And you know, anyone that's been listening to the Treasurer for any period of time would know that that's something that he's been talking about for a while, this idea of thinking about well-being and the things that contribute to Australians' well-being and how we get there. So there were pieces of the essay that, you know, I didn't necessarily agree with, but as a sort of broad vision, I think it's hits the mark.
And Richard, what were your thoughts?
I had a pretty similar reaction to Danielle, I think, which is it's sort of hard. I think you could read a lot into it. It was vague is probably not the right word because, you know, you're trying to write something that's the Treasurer was trying to write something that was broad and thoughtful and philosophical. So I think one could read into it whatever one really wanted. And so you've seen some members of the commentariat who are predisposed to think negatively of what this Treasurer is going to do have read very negative things into it. Others who are predisposed the other way read very positive things into it. I think my overall reaction was twofold, which was one, well, you know, the detail is really going to matter on a lot of these things.
Yes.
And secondly, I was on the more troubled side, I was a little worried with references to the American economist Mariana Mazzucato, who's an extremely left-wing thinker. And it's not bad to read people on the far left and on the far right, but the fact that she got name-checked was a little concerning. I would have been more interested in what Beyonce's thoughts on the economy were than Mariana Mazzucato, to be honest.
I would be very interested in Beyonce's thoughts on the economy because she is a very rich lady and she has done some hard work in that field. But yeah, it name-checked a lot of people and it seemed to be trying to give the impression of a very well-rounded individual. You know, he talked about Logan, he talked about Heraclitus and an ancient philosophy too. And we will talk about anything that you would like to talk about if you're listening to this discussion that comes under the heading of what would a better kind of capitalism look like. Is that possible? Is that something you'd like to see? Values-based capitalism is the phrase that our Treasurer Jim Chalmers has used in this kind of insight into his thinking that he's offered us all in a big essay in the Monthly. And to help guide us through the economic minefield, because you're lucky you don't just have me here, is Danielle Wood, CEO of the Grattan Institute, and Richard Holden, a professor of economics at the University of New South Wales Business School. Richard, just quickly, the backlash has been, some have said, shrill. Certainly it's been intense. Has that come from the business community or has it been more political in nature?
I think it's been a little more political in nature. I think the business community To use the sort of American baseball aphorism, no, not to swing at a pitch in the dirt. There's no reason for the business community to start freaking out about something that doesn't, you know, contain a policy that they need to react to. So annoying the treasurer is not something that's in the business community's interests. I think, you know, the members of the commentariat have a different role to play. You know, they're trying to read the tea leaves and I think they've sort of made a projection about what the implications of the treasurer's thinking are coming out of this essay. And so I think it's come more from them.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting watching some of the reactions, I have to say. We'll have a little look about what exactly Jim Chalmers means by values-based capitalism in a moment, but some of the reaction from our listeners already. One text says localization is the answer to the question as opposed to globalization. That's how we make it nicer. Please devote a show to this and interview Helena Norberg Hodge, is this suggestion, author of Ancient Futures. Interesting, we'll note that down. And fancy us having to legislate against greed, says another text. Human nature has to be overridden by civility, and by that I mean rules. That's from Annie in New South Wales. And Annie, we will talk about regulation and how much that's a part of the vision that Jim Chalmers is envisioning a little later as well. Julie's called in, though, from North Parramatta. Julie, what are your thoughts on this?
Oh, my thoughts are that as previous Labor governments have been advised, before you actually bring in policies, put it out there in your thoughts, such as Jim Chalmers has done, to prepare people to think about it. So I don't know why the commentariat is so enraged by it, because they're only doing what all governments should do.
You mean start a conversation and show exactly the direction that they've got in their head?
Exactly. And bring the people along with you gradually.
Well, yeah, as a dipping the toe in the water, I wonder if this startled Jim Chalmers, Julie, because he said, you know, it's been pretty intense, the reaction.
Yes, which is quite interesting, isn't it? They're like a lot of frightened mice.
Well, how did you feel about it? I mean, if you've heard or read anything about it in the papers, Julie, what were your thoughts on this idea?
I think it is a good start to changing the direction we've been going spiralling down over the last 10, 15 years. For instance, Norway. If only we'd done what Norway did with the mining boom, the once-in-a-lifetime mining boom. As Norway said to the mining companies, you can come in and mine this high-quality grade oil, but we as a nation are getting 70% of the profits, you get 30%, and they jumped at it. What did we do? It all went to shareholders overseas. It's about time someone started thinking of the nation, not just getting elected or their political parties.
Well, and I think the history probably is where we'll find out who most did that or is doing that right now. Julie, thanks for your call.
Thanks.
1300 225 576 is the number if you'd like to join in the conversation about values-based capitalism, what that might look like, what it should look like. Wes is in Eaglemont. I think that's the one in Melbourne. Hi, Wes.
Hi. Good morning. Look, you could use your taxation system to achieve some of these objectives. And by that, I'll give an example. Let's say I said to you, I'm going to knock off 5% of your income tax. Everybody say, terrific, thanks very much, Wes, but I'm going to have a sting in the tail. I'm going to charge you a carbon tax. And you could make that revenue neutral or even revenue negative, so nobody can complain. Businesses wouldn't have to pay as much group tax. People get money in their hands straight away, but you'd achieve your environmental objectives, getting people out of petrol cars, for example, or whatever your environmental objectives might be in the home. By people reducing their carbon emissions, and at the same time, they're not paying any more to do it. And so you achieve a social objective using a neutral tax system. I don't understand why we don't attach social objectives to the way we tax.
Yeah, Wes, it was interesting to see that the reaction from business included, oh, could we have some company tax cuts then if we're going to be asked to be doing more good things in the world? So, yeah. Paul is called in from North Sydney. Paul, what is your view on this?
Yeah, look, my view is that when it comes to government decision-making, the decision leans one way or another, and that is towards governments controlling the economy or the private sector controlling the economy. I personally believe the private sector does a better job with that. But on the issue of Jim Chalmers and his essay, one of the things I noticed is he is encouraging super funds to invest in public housing, which sounds very good, except for the fact that it doesn't return well. So where you have a choice, the private sector will choose a higher return. And for me, I've put my money into a self-managed super fund, and I'm quite pleased that I personally have the decision over how my super is spent and not Jim Chalmers.
Really good to have your perspective, Paul. Thank you. You're listening to Life Matters on ABCRN. And what's striking me about this reaction to Jim Chalmers' essay is that everyone's interested in it. Everyone's got a stake in it because the kinds of things he's talking about affect our everyday lives. You know, these giant economic currents and theories and goals eventually do trickle down, don't they? And sometimes quicker than at other times to affect everyone. So we've all got a stake in this. 1300 225 576. Do you think our capitalist economic system that we live under now can be made nicer and gentler, or does it need to change in different ways? Our guests today are Danielle Wood, who's the CEO of the Grattan Institute, and Richard Holden, who's a professor of economics at the University of New South Wales Business School. He's written a book called From Free to Fair Markets: Liberalism After COVID. Danielle, just quickly, the tenets of Jim Chalmers' ideas about values-based capitalism included three objectives: an orderly energy and climate transition, a more resilient and adaptable economy, and growth that puts equality and equal opportunity at the centre. Do you think we can do that in our current system with some tweaking, or is that a whole different set of conversations?
Look, I think there's certainly, I mean, the way that I would read the essay overall is that it's a role for government to be using its policy levers to run more actively at those things. So if we think about something like the climate transition, I think clearly there is a role for better designed government policy to help with what will be a massive economic transition for this country. So I think that the Treasurer is very right to flag that one as important. You know, we've been having a very long-running conversation in this country about equality and inequality, and particularly the lives of those at the bottom. As we know at the moment, you know, struggles with housing, struggles particularly for people on government income supports. Those are things that are all very much in control of government to do something about. The middle one around resilience, I'm a little less sure what he's driving at there, and that so that sort of component of the essay to me was a little unclear. But certainly, you know, I think those other big two are very much things that we as a country can do better at delivering.
Richard Holden, I mean, all economic and social systems have a set of values underpinning them. What are the ones underpinning our system now, and are they able to include the things that Jim Chalmers is after, well-being, inclusion, equity?
Yes, I think they do include those things. And you
but
know,
they're not delivering them all the time, are they?
No, they're not delivering them all the time. So I think there's an execution challenge with a lot of these things. So, you know, we have a system of a tax and transfer system that actually has led to the sort of post-tax and transfer Gini coefficient, the commonly used measure of inequality, you know, not increasing in the last two decades. Now, you can say the starting point was too high, but we don't have, you know, some large rise in inequality. We have arguably the best healthcare system in the world. Now, I think, you know, Mark Butler as health minister is doing the right things in saying it could be improved. We can have, you know, we've got some issues with GP and primary care physicians that need to be fixed in terms of bulk billing and so on. And it's right and proper to try and improve things all the time. But we've got a great healthcare system. We've got a system that really does focus quite a lot on a fair go. I think one area where we've sort of failed quite dramatically is in our education system. I don't think our education system is living up to the important role that it needs to play in terms of facilitating, you know, intergenerational inequality and so on. But I don't think it's like a system rethink. It's really about execution on some of these big policy areas.
There is a widening inequality gap, though, isn't there, in Australia?
No, there's not. Measured by the Gini coefficient. Inequality after accounting for taxes and transfers, which is the whole purpose of the tax and transfer system, inequality hasn't gone up in 20 years. So it's gone up in the United States, it's gone up in the UK, it's gone up in a bunch of other countries around the world, but not in Australia. Now, that doesn't mean we can't do better.
Richard, that it has, you know, if you take housing costs into consideration, it has, and certainly wealth inequality has gone up. Rich is talking about income inequality.
Ah.
So there are various measures you can draw in.
Good to have that clarification. I think we should take a few more calls. They're racking up here faster than I can keep up with them on Life Matters. While we've been listening to Richard Holden, Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales, and Danielle Wood, CEO of the Grattan Institute. Helen is in Canberra. And Helen, services is on your mind. Tell us why.
I'm concerned about services being delivered through competitive contracting systems. I'm specifically concerned with the delivery of English language programs to adult migrants, and those services are delivered through a competitive contracting system. And that means that the services are, the contracts are awarded on price criteria. And over my lifetime working in this area for a long time, I've seen really high quality programs junked because they cost too much, because somebody else can undercut it. And those programs, particularly for refugee youth, for example, there was an exemplary program in Melbourne that lost their contract because they couldn't compete against another provider who undercut. So what I would like to see is social values, and particularly the values that we want to have in a program such as English for Adult Migrants, governing the way in which contracts are awarded, and that the contracts, if a provider is delivering a good service, a quality service that can be shown to be such, then they should keep their contract and not have to compete again. In this field, it's something like now 90% of all teachers are either on casual or short-term contracts. It's also about 98% feminised. It's a classic example of female workers being pushed to the bottom of the pile, and adult migrants not getting what they deserve in an English language program.
It was interesting, Helen, to see that Jim Chalmers was talking a lot about training and getting our human capital right. Again, you know, not much concrete detail, but that sounds like a big job ahead of him because, as you say, there's a lot of different factors affecting that, casualisation being one of them. Pauline's in Brunswick in Melbourne. Pauline, you're thinking big. Tell us more about that.
Oh, well, I'm thinking big, and I'm also thinking very specific as well. Two things. The thing about economics that gets me is one of the most basic concepts is the concept of the market, that a well-informed person will make the best decision in their own interest, and then when you roll that all together, it will result in the best outcomes for a society. That sounds fine, and maybe 200 years ago it was fine, but we now have huge complex industries that spend their time making sure nobody has the best information. We've got marketing, we've got advertising, we've got PR. I don't know what percentage of the of the current employment of people are in those industries, but those industries are about distorting the market at the most basic level, so people cannot make the best decisions in their own interest. So that's the big one. The specific one, the very one about the execution within current political situation, is that government decisions often refer to the average income, which currently is around $100,000. Now, I'm not sure whether it's a person or a household, but a unit. But the median income, that is the point at which 50% of people get more and 50% of people get less, is 72,000.
It's very different, isn't it?
using the average absolutely distorts it in favour of the wealthy. It is distorted because of those on extremely high incomes, and they get favoured by the decisions based on average.
Well, Pauline, you've obviously done a lot of deep thinking about this. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today on the program. Eva Cox has called in. Now, we hear from you, Eva, from time to time on these big social issues. Thanks for calling in. What's your perspective today?
Well, I'm rather dubious about running it with the unions, the only extra possibility sort of being talked about being added into the big business and government. It just leaves society out almost entirely. And it sort of goes with the idea that that this is a way of, if you read it carefully, I've read the 6,000 word essay and I've read lots of other bits on it. Sorry, I'm sort of a bit croaky this morning. And the problem that we have is that I don't trust them. It's a very untrustworthy. I was involved in this stuff years ago, and if you look at my Boyer lectures, I predicted that sort of keeping the market model into things is not the way to sort of actually do things. I mean, big business is actually busy getting rid of the competition. So the whole idea that market forces gives people choices means that they don't get choices because big business makes sure they don't.
Well, interestingly, Eva Cox, you're on the same page as Peter Costello. I imagine, you know, that's a pretty rare occurrence, but he was saying, you know,
I usually don't agree on
well,
these
yeah,
sorts of
he said businesses exist to make money. That's their
money,
point.
Exactly.
They're a business. But what would be the alternative, Eva?
Well, the alternative is actually to sort of put society back as part of the thing. They've wiped out almost all the social programs and handed them over to the private sector, and we've got a complete mess in childcare as a result and a complete mess in aged care as a result. And the NDIS seems to have got itself into all sorts of things about that. I think we need to get back to the idea that those things that people need, like health and various other things, should not be subjected to market forces but to the needs of the people involved. And what worries me about Jim Chalmers stuff is that doesn't seem to be credited at all.
And it's interesting, Eva, how you... I want to take that up with, I guess, you mentioned that, you know, Jim Chalmers talks about business, government and labour. So he's talking about, you know, business, government and unions. Danielle Wood from the Grattan Institute, what do you see as the ideal role of unions in this, you know, change and shift towards value-based capitalism? If we're talking about including the perspective of people who work, what would that look like?
Look, it's an interesting question, and I should say I agree with the concern that Eva and Helen have raised around, it was touched on in the essay, the idea that a whole lot of areas that we care about, like housing services and other social services, that kind of market forces are going to play a big role. Ultimately, if we think these are things governments should provide, the role is for governments to find ways to fund these services. So when you're talking about sitting around a table, you know, business, unions, hopefully the broader social sector, as Eva has pointed to there, I think that each of those groups can play a role in thinking about broad directions. So, for example, the government's doing work on what does the future skills mix look like. Certainly, you want to be hearing from unions in those types of conversations. But that's a very different proposition to how do we best deliver social services. And there, I think the role for government may be informed by discussions with those other groups, but ultimately the role for government is to provide those services.
Well, and given that they haven't been to the standard or of the quality that people hope and expect for in things like aged care, disability and education, just to pick three, what do you think needs to happen there, Danielle? I mean, Jim Chalmers is saying, look, if we can make investment more strategic, if we can incentivise businesses to get involved in things that have a social good as well as a financial good, then that will help. Isn't that a useful way to look at it, given that, you know, it would be unbelievably hard to fund solely from the public purse the massive costs of disability as well as Medicare, education and aged care in future decades?
But essentially we do. The question is who provides.
Well, but not so, very well, yes, so far in
no,
some cases.
No, that's right, exactly. And so this is what I think the crux of this is. How do we do this better? So it goes to Richard's point about implementation. So we need to be where we have private and social services provision in these sectors. Governments need to be much better at specifying what they want them to do, because otherwise the risk is, and I think it was the previous caller, Helen, talking about it for migrant services, if we just do this on price, the private sector will have an incentive to cut back on quality. And, you know, those terrible stories we heard during the Aged Care Royal Commission effectively reflects that. We didn't contract those services well. So if the private sector is to remain involved, and it's very difficult given where we're starting with in these key sectors to see any other way, governments need to be much better at specifying what it is we want them to provide and making sure that the quality is at the heart of it as well as price.
Richard Holden, what would be a good way to incentivise companies to invest in aged care, education, disability, etc., without exacerbating those, as Danielle said, horrific problems that we saw from some elements of privatisation?
Yeah, well, I think Danielle makes a really, really good point about contracting. I think there are some things that are relatively easy for the government to contract on, and other things that are quite hard. So there's many things, and Eva pointed to a bunch of them. There's many things that we most of us agree the government should pay for. There's a separate question about what government should own or deliver by itself, rather than contract out. And most economists would say that if you can write a very good contract about what you want, then you're able, and electricity distribution is an example of that, poles and wires, you're able to get a lot of efficiencies out of the private sector. Something where it's classically very hard to do that, say prisons, you know, we really don't want to have, certainly in this country, private ownership of prisons, because they're going to not invest in rehabilitation services, dignity for prisoners, you know, quality of the provision. It's just very hard to contract on quality in that area. So when it comes to things like aged care, there's probably a mix of these things. Some people are going to have, you know, family members, or they themselves are going to be essentially consumers and are going to be able to make an informed decision about, you know, the quality of the service that they're receiving. Other people who might be more vulnerable aren't going to be able to do that. So I think the nuance is really all around not having a one-size-fits-all type approach to these things, saying there's going to be, you know, either zero government provision of aged care services or total government provision, but thinking about the balance in the middle. I think this also touches on, when you talk about getting the private sector, or Jim Chalmers talks about getting the private sector to invest, what it I think misses a little bit is the obvious trade-off when it comes to things. And one of your callers already mentioned this, which is if you know, if it's a good investment to invest in social housing, then super funds will have no problem investing in social housing. If it's not a good investment financially, might be a good social thing to do, but if it's not a good financial investment to invest in social housing, then what's going to happen is the Treasurer going to commandeer our superannuation funds and say, well, you're going to get a 1 or 2% lower return on your retirement savings every year compounded, but it's going to do social good. Now, I can't imagine that that's what he has in mind. So if you want the private sector to invest in things that create social value, the government needs to subsidise them. And make it an attractive financial investment. And that's a really important role for government, to tax things that do social harm, or if in the language of economics, create a negative externality like pollution, carbon emissions, and to subsidise things that create social good like education and healthcare and other things. And so I think what's missing from part of the essay and part of the discussion around it is there is, underlying all of this, a crucial role for government to play in internalising these externalities, be they positive or negative.
Yeah, and that's one, I think, of the big questions circulating around the essay. How big are you thinking that government should be? We would like to see some more detail on that. Lots of people wanting to get involved in this conversation with our guests Richard Holden and Danielle Wood. Text messages. Paula says, my philosophy professor said the free market will devour the planet. Good, that's one data point. And one other text said, it's depressing how much thoughtful intelligence we have and yet how stupidly our society lives. I don't know, I'm finding this conversation really stimulating and interesting because there's so many people who are deeply engaged with how we run our society. Kate from Canberra is one of them. Hello to you, Kate. You spent 6 or 7 years working in Wales implementing the Wellbeing Act there. What did you learn?
Well, the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act 2015 actually puts wellbeing and 7 wellbeing goals at the heart of government and creates those as an aim for not just government but all public sector bodies. So that really sets out, if you like, you know, the core social values and principles that underpin what all of government is trying to do. But as well as setting out goals for wellbeing, it also sets out 5 ways of working. And sometimes we forget that the way that we work is just as important as our values. So that embodies things like thinking long-term, preventing future problems, integrating across different policy areas, collaborating, and most importantly, involving people in what happens as part of the mandate for government.
That's really interesting, given, yeah, the focus on wellbeing in Jim Chalmers' essay. Kate, thank you for your call. Ian's next in Launceston. Hi, Ian.
Hi.
Lots of talk about the essay. What are your thoughts?
Oh, yes. I'd like to just point out that, in fact, there are 2 versions of the essay. And I suspect that for every person who's read the actual essay and is commenting, there are 20 people who have read the degraded, edited, and rather misleading version of the essay, which was published in The Australian last weekend. It does change and dilute the full intent of the author, and it shortchanges him by a long shot. And all I could really say is that, please, people, be very careful about selecting your sources before you form an opinion on the subject.
And it's not a hard read, is it, Ian? I mean, it's 6,000 words, sure, but he's a very engaging writer.
Yes, he is. But I've put the original next to the edited version, and I find it quite different. I mean, I could say perhaps it's chapter 1 of a character assassination masterclass, but... It really does not give anything like the full gamut of his opinions and background and sources, which he quotes, which are not requoted. And it's terribly important to have access to the sources that he uses in turn.
Yes, indeed. Well, and, you know, as you say, there is a lot being written about it, so you can pick your choice of commentaries and perspectives on this Jim Chalmers essay. But the full essay in the monthly is not paywalled, as of today at least. You can check it out for yourself. Stella is in Tabulum in the Northern Rivers. Hi, Stella.
Hello.
What are your thoughts on values-based capitalism?
Well, it's true, I haven't read the essay. Okay, so I will read it. And when you started talking about this topic this morning, and I think it starts with Chalmers saying something.
Yes, that's right. He had a grab saying, you know, basically he wants to strengthen our democratic institutions and we shouldn't have to choose between our economic and our social objectives.
Okay, yeah.
So he wants the public and the private sector working together in service of our economic goals, but also better wellbeing generally.
Yeah, right. Okay, so my instant reaction when I heard that was, well, you're either really, really smart, mate, or really, really stupid. But anyway, I haven't read the essay. With regard to values capitalism, well, what are the values of our capitalistic society at the moment, so-called Western democracies? How do we make our money? Predominantly from the industrial military complexes. And all the flow on from that, the trickle down, as Howard and everybody. Sure, it does trickle down eventually. But there's vast numbers of people that don't have those values. So we make money out of weaponry. We've created a system where there is so much corruption. Millions and millions of dollars. We just the other day had the cops on the radio how much they'd taken in some Chinese syndicate in the country. Then there was the real estate agent in Victoria at one point who had the accounts in Samoa. So we lose a lot of money. We are only 25 million. And sometimes, you know, you can look at our government and it's like a multiple choice. The government is there and says, well, there you go, citizens, you can have A, B, C or D.
But Stella, there is an argument that the capitalist system over the last, I don't know, 50 to 100 years has lifted a lot of people out of poverty. Like, it's raised wages around the world and made it possible for people to have a standard of living that was unimaginable for our grandparents. Do you feel like, you know, there's some good in with the bad?
Yeah, I would not, coming from a business family and in my being in my 60s, absolutely having the benefit of that. Okay. And I would not say that my family went to work every day just to make money. So, no, I don't think that businesses are there just to make money. I think, again, that's a particular type of value that exists within capitalism. I mean, the liberal, the small L liberal market capitalism really grew out of Manchurian England. And where did that come? It came out of the buccaneers and pirates that ran around the world. Our parliamentary system has evolved out of people, you know, fighting and working out how we're all going to live together in the market. The private market provides certain things. But unless it is told to look after the children, the damage, you know, you go to work for a company and you have an accident in a mine.
Yeah.
We've got 300 young men between 30 and 45 years of age with silicosis.
Yeah, and Stella, that's a key plank, I think, of Jim Chalmers' essay. When you do get a chance to read it, it's not a hard one. I hope you get a chance to run through it at some point. But thank you so much for your thoughts on the topic today. And Slobodan in Wodonga, you've been thinking about this quite deeply. Tell us what you've come up with.
Well, connected to the theme of today, I thought I should mention what I heard on the television a few months ago. Edward Snowden was talking to some, being interviewed by some American TV channel about the situation in the world and so on. And he was, by the way, asked how does he feel over there in Russia and what he thinks about Putin. Edward Snowden said, Putin is kind of not my cup of tea, but I can tell you one thing. In Russia and China, there are corporations, but Putin and Xi Jinping keep them very tightly under their thumbs. In the West, we got corporations also, and they keep the governments very tightly under their thumbs. That's nearly ad literam what I said. That's what he said. And I suppose that Edward Snowden would know much more than I do about the situation in the economies and of the world.
Yes, I imagine he has put some very deep thought into that. Slobodan, thank you. You're listening to Life Matters, and we're talking about the essay, the Jim Chalmers essay in the Monthly about values-based capitalism, but also the reactions to it, because it's really shown up, I think, how we think about our economic system and the role it plays in our lives as Australians, and what role we think it should play in meeting our social needs and the kind of equitable needs of our society as well. Our guests today are Danielle Wood, CEO of the Grattan Institute, and Richard Holden, who's a professor of economics and who's written a book called From Free to Fair Markets. A couple of questions have come out of those calls for me. Danielle Wood, can you change an economy without changing a culture as well? Because capitalism is not just an economic system, is it? It's the way we engage with the world in a lot of ways as well.
Look, I think that's a really critical point. And, you know, on that, you asked at the start, you know, why hadn't there been a backlash from business around this? You know, in a way, I think business culture is already here and has sort of evolved. I go to a lot of sort of corporate strategy days, et cetera, and, you know, this idea of
what the business sector calls ESG, environmental, social and governance issues, you know, not just thinking about profit in a short-term sense. Of course, business is about profit at the end of the day, but making sure that they're, you know, good corporate citizens, pushing towards, you know, better outcomes for the country is already there in the business world. So, that, you know, that is kind of part of that cultural piece. You know, we don't just kind of jump in and take every dollar that we can. We're worried about our social license to operate, and we're making sure that Australia is a good country to continue to operate in. So that the culture shift is really important too.
So some people argue that corporations are wanting to look good and they don't like the reputational damage because that impacts profits. So the actual driving force is still a profit-making thing.
It's still profits, that's right. And businesses are still there to make profits at the end of the day. So absolutely support that. But to the extent we can make those reputational things matter to them, it's more likely to then align with the broader goals of society.
Richard Holden, Jim Chalmers talks a lot about market design. How do you design markets for a well-being economy? Do you think he's talking about, you know, more government hands on the levers and somehow directing investment to where they would like it to go through, I don't know, regulatory frameworks? What's your sense of what he's talking about there?
There is actually a field of economics called market design, and it's really about creating transparency, creating sort of a good informational environment, and creating the right incentives to achieve certain kinds of outcomes. So, you know, one example of that is that the market for allocating kidneys in the United States used to not work very well at all. And there were a lot of people who needed kidney transplants who weren't getting them. There wasn't good matching of donors and people who needed to be recipients. And an American economist, Alvin Roth, who won a Nobel Prize for this whole line of work on market design, created a market that matched donors and those in need of kidneys better. And in fact, Al designed a bunch of other markets, including how doctors get matched to hospitals as residents and other things like this. So there's good economics behind this kind of thing. And I think this may well be part of what's in the back of the treasurer's mind. I think in this sort of broader debate about sort of when do markets work well and when do markets work poorly, markets tend to work well when there's good information about what's being produced and consumed in those markets. You know, if we, as Danielle was sort of alluding to, if we know whether somebody is making clothes with sweatshop labor in some foreign country, a lot of consumers don't want to buy those clothes. So all you have to do to get consumers to express their preference and discourage people from using sweatshop labor to produce t-shirts is to give people information about that. So sometimes it's information provision, and sometimes it's about giving people incentives to do things that are socially beneficial. And those incentives typically come, you know, in a financial form.
But that information provision has been shown to be incredibly difficult. Like the supply chain is really complicated and hard to trace back. And there's not much incentive for the companies to cough up that information in a lot of cases too, because they know that they'll take a hit to their profits.
No, I think that's exactly right. And that's why you typically need a combination of carrots and sticks in these instances. And that's why we have, you know, laws that make it, you know, sometimes even a criminal violation to conceal information about those things. So there's no suggestion that it's easy, but it's incredibly important. Mm. And I think a lot of progress has been made in various areas on these kinds of things.
Danielle Wood, some commentators are saying that the left should be pursuing a growth or abundance agenda. If we kind of have Jim Chalmers' essay in the back of our heads, do you think a sustainable growth agenda is possible? And if so, what would it look like?
Look, I think there is a fair criticism of the essay that perhaps Jim Chalmers didn't spend enough time talking about the opportunities to grow the pie and why that's important for everyone in society. So, look, I think a sustainable growth agenda looks at the long-term drivers of economic growth. Richard's mentioned education. You know, that is absolutely a critical one, and it's something, you know, we could be doing a lot better in our education system. That will be critical for our longer term economic outcomes. It looks at the way we embrace technologies, including digital technologies, to grow the economy. And it looks at the way in which government performs and interacts with the private sector, which is what the essay went to, in order to deliver that. So I think there is a bigger picture conversation about how do we ensure we continue to have economic growth, but economic growth that doesn't destroy the environment, and economic growth that filters through so that everyone is gaining from that growing size of the pie.
Yep. We'll take a final quick call from Christopher, because he's into that idea of doing things the way we are but differently as well. Christopher from Sydney, welcome. We've got about 30 seconds left. Can you tell us your point in nut form?
I think there's a problem with management. We've been talking about contracts earlier and everything, and every time you work with government works with a private enterprise, that private enterprise needs to give a return to their shareholders. If a government put a good manager into the situation, they could get that 10% going to the users and to the service provider. Of course, working with cooperation with the power elite is important, but it talks about efficiency and talks about getting things done. I don't see that it's a romance that private people do it better than government people. There's even a lot of research around that says bureaucracies in the private enterprise are actually much less efficient than government enterprise bureaucracies. So we really need to think this through, this process, better than just saying, oh, a private enterprise does it better than government. I think that's a load of bull.
Christopher, thanks for your call. This is Life Matters on ABC RN. A lot of reactions, a lot of ideas to toss around. Danielle Wood, Richard Holden, thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Helen.
Thanks for the conversation.
Danielle Wood, CEO of the Grattan Institute, very much appreciate you being part of this conversation. Richard Holden is a professor of economics at the University of New South Wales Business School. His book is called From Free to Fair Markets: Liberalism After COVID.
ABC RN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.